You're listening to Precinct 444, a podcast network from the National Law Enforcement Museum. Today, we're bringing you an episode from Icons, where listeners are introduced to incredible people working within law enforcement who have had a profound impact on the community. These one-on-one interviews provide insight into their lives and careers so we can better understand their challenges and recognize their bravery, commitment, and sacrifice.
FirstNet, the nationwide public safety broadband network, evolved over time to what it is today after a breakdown of communication among first responders during the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. Over the last two decades, FirstNet has become a reliable means of communication among first responders, but it has not always been this way. We've divided this series into four segments. In this first segment of the story of the FirstNet Authority, Harlan McEwen and Chuck Dowd discuss some of the communication challenges first responders faced prior to the events of September 11th. And now, for segment one of the story of the FirstNet Authority.
Chief, it's delightful to have you with us today, and I really appreciate your participating in this. I want to start actually taking you back to very early in your life, actually. Your introduction to radio communication when you were a teenager kind of set the stage for things. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I always had an interest in wireless communications and radio. In my early teenage years, I was very interested in this. That's how I got interested in police and fire communications and started monitoring. You could buy in those days an analog monitor to monitor police and fire calls. So I started getting to know the jargon and know the people, actually, and get to know them personally in my small hometown. And that led me to become a part-time police fire dispatcher when I was still, in my early college days. And from there, I got offered a police job, and that just led to my whole public safety career.
And I have to assume that that early exposure to the fire side of things, coupled with all that you've done since in the police realm, that's a nice combination of things, given where you ended up in shepherding so much in public safety communication.
Well, I think it was very important that I had over 20 years as a volunteer firefighter, having some sense of that side of the public safety world. Actually, in my early days as a police officer, I actually drove an ambulance part-time. In those days, it was load them up and run. You didn't have much medical experience. You had some first aid training and stuff. But so all of that experience led to a really what I would call enlightened understanding of the full public safety realm.
Let's get a sense of what the radio technologies were like back then. Can you just tell us back in your earlier days, right up to when you became chief of police, what was the technology like? What were you working with?
Well, it was very simple, really. I mean, the in my days back in the early 50s, and then when I became a police officer in 1957, tells you how far back I go. It was just analog radio. There were no real portable radios. There were these big, heavy battery radios with a telephone handset or a microphone. We were on low band in the 30 megahertz band in those days, which traveled a long distance. We could talk to people a long ways away who were sharing the frequencies. And it was quite different because, there were mobile radios in police cars and fire trucks and ambulances, but they were pretty simple devices. And then I lived through the first narrow banding from, 25 megahertz down to 12.5 megahertz in the analog area, and eventually we started even narrow banding it further. But so it was a very basic kind of thing. As I continued my experience in law enforcement, eventually Motorola came out with the first handheld portable radio. They were quite a game changer because now you could get out of the car and still talk if you had sufficient power to reach the base station and so on.
Now, as those technologies were evolving back then, did you have a sense of possibilities? I know that we don't know what we don't know, and you don't know what technologies might be appearing on the horizon. But did you find yourself even back then thinking, boy, if we could only ...
I'm sure I've always had that kind of a thinking. I've always been a visionary person. But I can tell you that in those days, I really didn't have much of a vision. I didn't understand how quickly technology would change over the years and how things would eventually end up today. I mean, I will tell you, in those days, it would be unimaginable what we've accomplished today.
Certainly, it must have been important in terms of your professional evolution that, as I understand it, by the late 1970s, you had become a go-to guy for the police community when it came to technology and various issues that would come up for them. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I first became a police chief in 1972. And I, again, continued my interest in communications, and I became an active member of the New York State Association of Chiefs of Police. I was appointed chairman of their communications committee. And in that role, I started to get active in, how things were developing and what we needed to do to make it work. So that began my interest in the statewide. In 1978, the president of the International Association of Chiefs of Police at the time was Wilson Pat Spear, who was the director of the Texas Rangers in the Texas Department of Public Safety. And the incoming president after him was from New York State. Chief Joe Dominelli recommended that I be appointed to the International Chiefs Communications Committee. It turned out that that year, 1978, the chairman of the committee had stepped down, and so not only was I made a member, I was made the chairman, which threw me right into the fire because I had to learn how to do that. But I served then in that role for 37 years. So I was reappointed by 37 presidents of the IACP each year. But that's how I got involved internationally and learned the trade, so to speak, learned from, very well-understood engineers, people who understood the whole realm of things, and became a subject matter expert nationally and internationally.
And I have to assume that the connections you made at the FCC and elsewhere must have helped a great deal and probably was leveraged later on.
There's no question about it. I mean, I became the principal spokesperson for the law enforcement community in this country on matters of radio communications and technology, and got to know each of the FCC chairpersons over the years personally, met with them in their offices and many of the commissioners, and was an advocate for improvements, new spectrum, and so on.
Was this a widely held perception that, hey, we have an enormous problem when it comes to public safety communication? Or were you trying to impress upon people who were somewhat blind to it?
Well, the problem became increasing over my years in this role. And what happened is that the normal police radio systems, which were licensed, Landmobile radio licenses were licensed to thousands of police, fire, and EMS agencies, their spectrum that they had limited use for became increasingly crowded, mainly in the urban and city areas. And what happened is we needed more and more spectrum the way it was organized in those days. So that put me right into the front runner of advocating for increased spectrum, and that's how really the journey to FirstNet all kind of started.
And I'm compared to you, certainly a huge novice in this area, but my sense is that we have the FCC moving to narrowband, you have the conversion to digital from analog. What was happening then to the ability to exchange data as a result? I may be just asking you to reaffirm what you're saying, but it seems that that development really brought to light those problems.
It was a major issue, and that was that as the FCC narrowed the spectrum from what I called wideband, or from very wide channels to narrower channels, it became less lesser ability to actually transmit data. For instance, we started to be able to share fingerprint data. Sharing a single fingerprint on the narrower radio broadband, as I remember it, it took 26 minutes if you were going to transmit one single fingerprint on that particular, which was not reasonable nor expected, you know, to work. So we started realizing that sending mugshots and building plans and things of that nature, we needed to have that capability. And narrowing the radio spectrum channels didn't work. So we started advocating for wideband channels, which is what they called them in the beginning. Eventually they became broader and became broadband channels.
Now, you keep, of course, mentioning that, you know, we started advocating, et cetera. Mm-hmm. My sense is there were moments or periods of time where you were something of a lonely voice. Wouldn't that be accurate?
Well, there's probably some truth to that. But, I mean, I always enlisted people from the Fire Chiefs Association, the Sheriff's Association. You know, I was the principal from the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Most of the other public safety organizations did not have the technical member capability that I had, and so they enlisted my support. I began to be the representative for all of them in many of these topics and enlisted the help of their leadership. You know, each year when something was going on, I would reach out to the presidents of the Fire Chiefs Association, the major city chiefs, police chiefs, national sheriffs, National Association of State EMS officials, and so on, and bring them all together. I would educate them on the topic and gather their support for me to lead the effort to make change.
I don't want to gloss over the hard work it must have been to bring those entities together, to bring police, fire, EMS on board and aligned. What was involved for you in working to bring them together? I know that there tend to be rivalries of sorts, or at least they don't always have shared perspectives. How did you do it? How did you bring them together?
Well, I think that I brought a unique perspective to the table. Certainly there were rivalries between the police chiefs and the sheriffs and the fire chiefs and others. But in this arena, communications and technology, they all lacked a common understanding of the issues. And they looked to me as a common person of expertise. They trusted me. I have to tell you, the presidents of each of those organizations changed every year. And I had to renew my their trust in me. But it was a wonderful experience. I mean, I have to tell you, this was the one area where they all came together and we worked together for a common purpose.
So the light bulb really did go on for all these chiefs and all these separate entities.
Yeah, it was very, very heartwarming that they did that.
At the same time, or perhaps not at the same time, maybe it was sequential, but you can let me know. You had to work on the government side. You needed to get Congress's attention.
Yep.
Can you tell us a bit about that? Because that has to be heavy lifting.
Well, in my role, again, as the chairman of the Communications and Technology Committee at the International Association of Chiefs of Police, I was invited many times to testify before Congress. In my career, I have testified dozens of times, over hundreds, you know, I mean, really a lot of times. It's hard for me to count. And in those in that role, I often represented the viewpoint of all of those different organizations, and started to get the attention of Congress, which, you know, really leads to how FirstNet really became, you know, of interest.
I love the idea of giving proper due to those who championed the cause. And I know in the past you've referenced Hal Rogers and his role. Can you talk to that role and what he did to really help propel things?
Congressman Rogers, who was chairman, I think, of the Ways and Means Committee in the House of Representatives in 1995, reached out to me when I was police chief in Ithaca, New York, and said, we've heard from various constituents that the public safety community needs some additional radio spectrum, and we're wondering how we can help you with this issue. And so I explained to the congressman and his chief of staff that we didn't feel that we were getting the appropriate attention from the Federal Communications Commission and the chairman at the time to address that need. So what happened is that they, right after that discussion, there was a hearing. They always have an annual agency budget hearing in Congress, and Chairman Rogers held a hearing with the FCC chairman and asked the question about how they were addressing the need that he felt we needed, and they said, well, they were studying the matter and so on, and I remember the chairman of the committee, Chairman Rogers, saying, well, would you please decide how you're going to really fix this problem? And when you do, come back to us and we're going to discuss your budget. But in the meantime, I want you to really take a serious look at this. That's really how the beginning of FirstNet. We didn't really know what FirstNet was going to be at the time, but that's how it all started.
So you needed someone running interference, so to speak.
We did. Yeah.
Others who also helped out?
Well, there were others in Congress, but that was the major issue. And then as a result of that, the FCC chairman and the head of the National Telecommunications and Information Agency or Organization Authority, administration is the title, how they created a committee called the Public Safety Wireless Advisory Committee. That committee, chaired by an attorney, Phil Verveer, was really the thing that started to change everything in our life. That committee worked for quite a while, a couple of years, recommended that the public safety community was in urgent need of at least 97.5 megahertz of additional radio spectrum. And then they set forth some of the reasons and how that should be done. As a result of that, the committee, you know, the recommendations were taken up by Congress. Congress eventually told the FCC, we want you to allocate an additional 24 megahertz of spectrum, you know, in the what was going to be the unused spectrum that was being vacated by television broadcasters to move from analog to digital services. So that was the big step. That was the beginning of how we got broadband technology for public safety.
I know that there was resistance that had to be overcome. Can you help me understand the nature of the resistance on Capitol Hill that had to be addressed and had to be surmounted?
Well, first of all, spectrum is worth a lot of money. Spectrum is valuable to the industry of the country. People use radio spectrum for all kinds of services. And there were lots of people who wanted that radio spectrum that were competing with us. And many of them, not understanding the total problem, you know, said, well, you've already got a lot of spectrum. We need spectrum and we don't have it. And we should have it. So there was always that competing kind of discussion on the Hill. To be very honest with you, a lot of our success in the public safety community is the result of the collaboration, not only of the public safety organizations, but of the state and local government organizations, like the Conference of Mayors, the Association of Governors, League of Cities, the Association of Counties. All of those kinds of organizations, due to our efforts of going to them and saying, here's the problem, and here's what we need, and we need your support, we eventually won them over. And with all of that kind of, you know, unified activity, it was hard for Congress to ignore.
As you approached the various states and localities, did you have to tailor the approach to each one? Was there a somewhat different offering, or was it, here's what we're doing, and this is what it's going to be, and we need you on board? How much did you have to address concerns and perhaps, as I said, tailor things?
Well, with thousands of licenses nationwide, police, fire, and EMS, they all were different, really, every one of them. And they had different kinds of radio equipment, different manufacturers, different different models of equipment and all of that. So it was very, very hard. So in the beginning, I mean, we had no sense of a nationwide effort. We were looking at trying to serve the needs of all these thousands of different organizations. You know, in 2006, the light bulb went on with Morgan O'Brien. Morgan O'Brien invited me to have lunch with him out at the Hilton at the Dulles Airport in 2006, and advanced to me as a nationwide subject matter expert and leader in this arena the idea of building a new nationwide single network that would offer data capability and broadband technology. Quite a unique thing. And to be very honest with you, my initial reaction was, I don't believe this is practical nor even possible. But he was always a visionary. He was one of the co-founders of Nextel. And they built, you know, they took and put pieced together lots of different spectrum and made a nationwide network of their own. So he had done it in a similar fashion with older technology. And he believed in it. And he eventually convinced me. And then I began to advocate it to others. And eventually the community came around it. So that's how it all started.
Let me take you back to 2001 and the tragedy of 9/11.
Right.
What happened or didn't happen that day that ended up being a catalyst for change?
Well, again, that's an interoperability topic. So New York City, not unlike many communities, the fire department, the police department, and the EMS agencies were all on different radio frequencies. They had competing interests. Those interdisciplinary interests weren't often very good. And when the tragedy occurred on, you know, on 9/11, 2001, probably a lot of, in particular, mostly fire lives were lost because they were unaware of the collapse of the first World Trade Center and the fact that they were in danger going up into those towers. The police were more aware of it, and they didn't really have a good way to communicate with each other. So I think that was the catalyst for a lot of the thinking about interoperability. So we weren't thinking about a nationwide solution at the time. We were thinking about local solutions, about how do we better intercommunicate between different disciplines. And the commission that was created to look at the failures of that included a communications element, which was really a catalyst to that.
And then moving on in time a bit, in 2007, as I understand it, the not-for-profit corporation, the Public Safety Spectrum Trust,
right.
was formed, and you were the chairman. Can you tell us about the significance of the work that was done with the trust?
Yeah, so again, working eventually again with Morgan O'Brien, who we hired as our advisor, and who helped us raise money to make it to carry out the effort. We created a not-for-profit corporation called the Public Safety Spectrum Trust. The FCC at the time was starting to look at Morgan's idea of a nationwide effort, and they put out notices about how they were going to require people to apply for a nationwide broadband license. We, you know, several of us, you know, I was included, put together this not-for-profit corporation. I was elected the chairman throughout its existence. And all of the major public safety organizations participated, the fire chiefs, the police chiefs, and sheriffs, and so on. We really laid the foundation for how a nationwide broadband network would work. So we spent a lot of time, a couple of years, putting that all together. What we finally realized was that we didn't have the finances to be able to make that happen. And without some kind of congressional action, the thing just wasn't going to fly. So that's when, you know, we finally started looking at a different model. But we held the license. We got the license from the FCC for the first 10 megahertz of spectrum in 2007. It was a 10-year license. That was a big step in the right direction towards this effort. But eventually that led to our realization that that particular model wasn't going to work.
And the shift in the model became trying to get Congress to authorize seed money, correct?
Right.
How in the world does that come about? Because funding issues are partisan issues, and you're bringing both sides of the aisle together, hopefully, on this issue for you. How did that work?
Well, what happened is, again, and you're going to be talking with other people who, you know, I'm going to give you the foundation of all this, but and have been through it right up till today, but you're going to be talking to other people to kind of enlarge upon that. But in 2009, a number of people came together under the auspices of the Major City Police Chiefs Association. They invited a whole bunch of people, realizing that this wasn't going to work the way we were going down that path. We met here in Washington, began to discuss how are we going to look at a different model, came to an agreement that we were going to have to advocate for a nationwide network that was going to require some different kind of funding mechanism. Over a period of time, we developed our strategy, our position, started advocating with Congress. The main issue was a funding issue. It was spectrum. We needed additional spectrum, and we needed a major infusion of funding. I'm not quite sure it was a brainchild of a number of people, including me, that we not use taxpayer money, that we use spectrum auction money. The FCC was in the process of starting to auction off some considerable spectrum. Big carriers were prepared to pay billions of dollars for that. So we asked for, I think as I remember, we were asking for something like $12 to $15 billion. We eventually got $7.2 billion out of that money. That first auction that we were pinpointing actually gained over $20 billion. We were lucky enough to get Congress to agree to assign $7.2 billion for this effort for the nationwide network, which is now known as FirstNet. The rest of the money was mainly to go to the federal deficit. You know, it's kind of mind-boggling. I mean, I think in terms of dollars and maybe at the most $100. But when you're talking about billions and trillions of dollars, it's mind-boggling. But that's what happened.
So we have the creation of FirstNet, which many people I've talked to said is the accomplishing of the impossible.
Right.
What do you feel most proud of in terms of your personal role in this?
Well, you know, I certainly do not take sole credit for any of this. I want it to be clear that, you know, I served in a leadership role. A lot of other people stepped up. I mean, if it hadn't been for some of the people that you will be talking with in some of these other podcasts and their efforts to step into the arena and all of us come together in one unified voice again to accomplish something that we felt was important to the community, it wouldn't have happened. So I feel, you know, I was a very integral, very important part of that. Probably the sole person in that group that had the history of how to work with the FCC and the Congress and so on, but certainly not the sole voice in what made it happen.
Finally, Harlan, looking ahead, what would you most like to see FirstNet do, accomplish, that perhaps represents a challenge that's not been totally met just yet?
Well, first of all, I'm absolutely thrilled and amazed at the progress that's been made. I mean, once, you know, none of what is happening today was in my vision back many, many years ago. I mean, it's just wonderful what's happened. First of all, the fact that we got Congress to pass the legislation to create this network. And it was very clear they wanted a single public safety network where we didn't have competing interests that we were using, focused technologies and not competing technologies and things of that nature. The second thing that was important was the fact that the contract was awarded to AT&T. The fact that AT&T stepped up to the plate, made the commitment that they were going to, you know, provide a service to public safety as a part of their corporate responsibility and take this to the next level was very critical. The fact that they're building and maintaining and refreshing this network now on a regular basis is just wonderful. I mean, they're just doing a fantastic job. Just last week, they released the latest numbers. There's over 4 million FirstNet connections as of last week. Just hard to believe when you think about it. I mean, nationwide, there's over 200 applications in the FirstNet catalog. I mean, we think of, as a public, we think of the App Store and the iPhone arena, the Google store, you know, where you get applications. But in this arena, these young application developers that like to build applications for use in the wireless arena are now building applications just for public safety because they've got a home for it and a place to sell it and to distribute it. So all of those kinds of things are happening. The fact that AT&T has built out a huge improvement in their coverage nationwide with the public safety band 14 spectrum is a big game changer. It actually has provided to some people in small rural communities service on a secondary basis that they never would have had, no cell service at all. I know of one little community up in the woods of Vermont, or New Hampshire rather, where I heard about them getting cell coverage because of the public safety network. They never would have had it because there's no commercial, it's not profitable for a carrier to build in those little places, you know? So, you know, I think where we are today is amazing. It's hard, again, for me to envision where we might be going. The technology is changing. We can do all kinds of things in this network that we never could do before. We have high-powered user equipment in that network, which is authorized under FCC rules that are different than you can get in any other carrier's network. Your normal cell phone transmits 0.2 watt. We can transmit up to 1.25 watts of power in public safety devices, which gets you to cell phone towers in fringe areas that you could never reach before. These are all game changers for public safety and for this country.
It will certainly be exciting to see how FirstNet continues to evolve. And I must say, we all owe you quite a debt of gratitude because your impact has been felt throughout the history of public safety communication and ultimately the creation of FirstNet. So, Chief, I want to thank you for being with us today.
Great. I'm pleased to be with you and to talk about some of this history.
Thank you for listening to segment one of the story of the FirstNet Authority, a Precinct 444 podcast of the National Law Enforcement Museum. You just heard from Harlan McEwen, and here to conclude segment one is Chuck Dowd.
Chuck, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you here.
It's great to be here, Bill. Thank you.
I want to start by taking you back before you were handling communications within the New York Police Department.
Sure.
And that was quite a few years because I believe it was 2000 when you took over the communications role.
Yes.
So in those years prior to 2000, is it accurate to say that, like your fellow police officers, you really weren't aware of the problems and certainly the extent of the problems with public safety communications?
No, and that is correct, Bill, because, you know, from a perspective of a layman in when it came to communications technology, which virtually everybody is in law enforcement and in public safety, the extent of my sophistication was that I knew there was something called a repeater out there that retransmitted your transmission. Other than that, I had no expertise and no idea how communications capabilities worked.
So how did you end up with that portfolio of communications, and how soon into that job were you made fully aware of the problems?
So like many things in the NYPD, you know, you get to an executive level. I became a captain, and you go where you're told to go, right? So I got a phone call one day from the police commissioner who said, you're going to run the New York City 911 system and radio operations. I need you to do a good job. And he hung up the phone, right? So that's how I got into it. So it took a couple of years to really fully understand the technology. Now, the operational side was much more quick. I could understand that, all right? But when it came to the technical side, I was way behind the curve. So it took a good 2 years.
And yet 9/11 hit not that long after.
No,
you took
it,
over.
It actually hit a year after. So, you know, it was baptism by fire, so to speak. It was a horrific event, and the things that happened on that day and in the aftermath of that really hit home with me as far as trying to understand where our failures were. One of the most difficult things about making change, Bill, is the first step is, and this is difficult for most people, including myself, is to acknowledge the failures. And there were failures. And so you needed to acknowledge those. And then once you did that, and once we did that collectively, now it's like, well, what's the solution to this problem?
I remember in an earlier conversation with you, you were telling me about a searing incident, searing for you, when a fire lieutenant made a 911 call from high up in
World Trade Center. Yeah, so one of my responsibilities was, you know, maintaining those records, the tape and record systems from 911 and from communications. And one day I was reviewing 911 calls from inside the towers, and there were about 35 of those. And one of the one that you mentioned that really struck me and stayed with me forever was it was a call from a fire lieutenant from the FDNY calling, I think, from the 15th or 20th floor, looking for resuscitation equipment because there was a firefighter in cardiac arrest. And they were unable to reach them by radio. And that struck me as, you know, aside from all the other problems we had, as something that just really hit home. Yeah.
And it was emerging in your consciousness more and more that broadband had to be the answer.
Sure. So, well, we didn't know that it would broadband up front, but we knew there had to be something different. That we were looking at two different issues at that point. Number one was the ability to communicate across public safety, right? So, and not just locally, but on a nationwide level. We needed a change, right? The other thing that was happening was, while we were primarily voice at the time in public safety, we saw data as an emerging tool that was going to be a major factor in public safety. So looking at those two issues, the issue to be able to communicate more broadly on a nationwide basis and data led us to the logical conclusion that broadband was the solution for public safety going forward.
Was the real-time crime center one of the strong indicators to you that data was emerging as a powerful aspect?
Absolutely, it was. So Ray Kelly comes in as the police commissioner, and the comment he used to make is, we're a large organization, 50,000 people in the NYPD, and we don't know what we know. So you could have two detectives working a case, a detective in the Bronx and a detective in Brooklyn, and they may have some synergy between their cases that they don't know about and wouldn't know about because they might as well be a million miles apart. They didn't know that there's a piece of information in both their cases that would link those cases, and they had no ability to do that. So the real-time crime center revolutionized detectives' abilities to do investigations.
And as you began to promote internally broadband,
sure,
you faced some pushback, and within the police department, what was the nature of the hesitation or actual resistance?
Well, again, it's change. It's anything new is can be scary to people that have been doing this a long time. I had the good fortune to have a tremendous technical staff when it came to communications technology. But it was all focused on land mobile radio, two-way voice radio. And so we needed to look in a different direction, and that was broadband. And that made people uncomfortable. It made them nervous because it was a technology they weren't familiar with, and they didn't really understand its potential impact, I think.
So there was some resistance even within your technical staff, but there were also strong advocates. And I'm going to shine a spotlight on someone named Jim, you mentioned, who seemed to see where things were headed.
So Jim Hassett was a guy that, and he's still with the NYPD today. His background was he worked with New York City EMS, New York City Fire Department, and then ultimately with the NYPD. And Jim, at one point, when I was talking to him, made an interesting comment. He said, look, Chief, he said, at some point here, public safety is going to have to move on to a new technology as everything moves on. And that was broadband. And the comment he made, which I thought was very, very telling, very forward thinking, was that at some point that public safety is going to realize they don't want to support two separate technologies. The expense of maintaining LMR and broadband would occur to police executives, fire executives, public safety executives, that they didn't want to support two technologies. And he said that to me early on, and it was like the 2007, 2008 timeframe. So it was, and that's what's happened. So I have to give him a lot of credit for being very forward thinking.
And you had a message for your team that this wasn't going to work if it only worked for New York City.
Yeah, so one of the things that New York City, you know, is it's just a reality out there that we have to confront. It's like everybody likes to hate the New York Yankees. Well, you know, to some extent, you get that with the NYPD. Well, you know, they think the world revolves around them, right? But the reality is that when this concept started to gel, I said to my guys on the technical staff, I said, look, can this work? And they said, yes. I said, fine, it'll work for us. Yes. I said, but it can't just work for us. It has to work for everybody. If it works in New York City, it has to work in Topeka, Kansas. It has to work in a small town in North Dakota. If it doesn't work for everybody, then it doesn't work.
So the process of getting started with what eventually became FirstNet involved getting a lot of players on board. You had the public safety community, you had the commercial networks, you had the federal government. Let's start with public safety. Why was it so important to get everyone united behind the cause and the effort?
Well, because without that, we weren't going to move anywhere. Washington is an interesting place. So we were coming here looking for radio spectrum in order to build this nationwide network. But to get the political side of things behind this, Congress, you know, the Obama administration at the time, we needed to ensure that we spoke with one voice in public safety. And without that, they're not going to move forward. So we could go in and speak to people on Capitol Hill and go into congressional offices and say, we need you to support this. But if they're going to turn around and say to us, well, you know, the fire guys were in last week and they don't agree with you, then we're not going anywhere. So one of the critical hurdles was getting, well, the first critical hurdle really was getting public safety to get behind this with one voice and say, this is something we want. This is something we support.
And how is that unity accomplished? I mean, I've heard from others that, for example, there was a critical meeting in Washington, D.C. of top officials across the public safety community. From your perspective, that is heavy lifting. How is it accomplished?
Leadership, you know, level of effort. You have to have folks that believe in it and that can convince others that this is the way to go. I know you've spoken with Chris Moore. Chris Moore was critical to this. Jeff Johnson on the fire side was critical to this. Dick Murgon from APCO. All of these guys were critical to getting this effort done. Without that core group of folks, you know, and there were certainly others. Harlan McEwen obviously was one. Without those folks behind this, we never could have convinced the public safety community in mass to support this effort. And that took a while to do.
Were you surprised that the unity came about?
You know what? I from my own personal perspective, I always look at it from a positive perspective. I believe that when you start something like that, you have to believe it's going to happen. If you don't believe it's going to happen, I think it makes it that much more difficult to make it happen. And so I believed it would, but it wasn't easy. But we did ultimately, we were able to get everybody on board and on the same page looking to support this.
And as for the commercial networks, they came on board, but weren't they on board as long as they didn't have to give up any spectrum?
Right. So again, you know, we had the good fortune of being in a position where spectrum became available, the D block in the 700 range of spectrum that came available across the country. This was really a one-time opportunity, which is another way that we sold this inside public safety. We said, look, and to the political side of things in Washington, we said, when you look at this, this is a one-time opportunity. You know, this spectrum is available across the country. That's not going to happen again anytime soon. And so it's either kind of a now or never. Either we're going to do this now or it's not going to happen. So that was a critical factor in this.
And then the heaviest lift of all, which was getting the players in the federal government to line up behind this. And you had a series of champions, really, on Capitol Hill and within the executive branch.
We did. And I'll probably miss some of them here, but clearly some of the ones that were most critical to this, Peter King, congressman from New York, was the first person to sponsor legislation for us. That was critically important. That got us up and running. Others that were involved, another critical member of Congress was Senator Jay Rockefeller on the Senate side. He was our champion over there. His level of effort was tremendous, and his staff. I mean, Jessica Rosenworcel, who is the current FCC chair, was on Jay Rockefeller's staff at the time, and she was critically important to us getting this done.
Would it be accurate to say that it was important to get a progression of support on the Hill and from the White House in order to get those who were resistant among the politicians to finally say, it's not going to pay to oppose this?
Yes. So one of the things we did, and you've probably heard this story before, there was a meeting in Washington where we all got together and we had all the carriers there and some other companies that were involved with public safety communications. And we told them, listen, we need this. And so the White House at the time was not completely convinced. So this meeting was a critical meeting for us because it was at that meeting that the carriers all said individually, we will not give public safety the type of service that preemptive priority to their networks, that level of coverage and redundancy. We can't do that for them because we have commercial customers that we're obligated to. It was at that point that the White House technology staff realized that this was something that had to happen because the carriers were all saying, we're not going to do it for them. And that was okay. We understood their priority was different than our priority. And that as it was at that juncture that the White House realized that this was something they needed to get behind.
So you had the support you needed, ultimately culminates in the setting up of FirstNet. There's an interesting anecdote I recall you mentioning to me earlier that involved Hurricane Sandy and getting a kind of wake-up call for some on the newly minted board of FirstNet.
Sure. So one of the things that can come out of an incident like Hurricane Sandy is an understanding of what true need is. That storm was devastating to, you know, the South Shore of New York City, including where I lived in Staten Island, along the South Shore, Coney Island in Brooklyn, the Rockaways in Queens. It devastated those areas. And what we did was the board of directors had just been recently formed in the last couple of months. So we brought them to New York and we drove them around all of those areas to show them the devastation, to show them the effect of the loss of the commercial networks in those areas. You know, the carriers at the time would have said to us, you know, 95% of our sites stayed up in New York City. But what got left out of that story a little bit is that the 5% of the ones that did go down were in those areas where they were most critically needed. And that's the difference between a commercial versus a public safety network, is that our networks stayed up in those areas and their networks went down. So the commercial members of the board that had just come in and together with us, and we're trying to understand them from a commercial perspective, and they're trying to understand us from the public safety perspective. It was eye-opening for them to see what had happened in New York City during Sandy.
This, I suppose, speaks to not just coverage, but survivability as critical.
Sure. So part of that, there are three critical factors. One was the priority issue for us. The second one is coverage. And the third one is network survivability. Network survivability is critical because you need, you know, when there's a failure, when there's a hurricane, when there's a September 11th attack, all of these things affect your infrastructure. When there's a blackout, all of those things affect your ability to communicate. And that's when you need it most. That's when it's most critical. That's when that's when public safety networks need to function. That's when they're needed the most. So that was, again, an eye-opening issue for the board of directors of FirstNet, particularly for those on the commercial side.
So FirstNet has been clearly very successful. What has surprised you most about the degree of success or the pace of success?
So I think one of the concerns that I had, and I voiced this to the executives inside AT&T early on in this process, was the concern that the potential for FirstNet to get swallowed up by the commercial side inside AT&T. And what I'm really pleased to see so far is that the opposite has happened, that the public safety imperative has caught fire inside AT&T, that the executives inside AT&T understand its value, not only to the public safety customers, but to their commercial customers. Because if you can satisfy public safety, then you do satisfy your commercial customers as well. So what's been gratifying is to see the level of effort and the focus on FirstNet as a priority inside AT&T. Now, that said, This is a work in progress. There's a long way to go, but we're headed in the right direction. And I'm pleased to see that the opposite didn't happen, where the public safety side got swallowed up by the commercial side. Actually, it's gone the other way, which I think is not just in public safety's interest, but also in the public's interest and in AT&T's interest, quite frankly.
Because in fact, an industry has been built up around the public safety community.
Absolutely. One of the things that we were told as this was going forward and the legislation got passed by those that, you know, just didn't see this as the future, right? At least initially. And they were saying, well, no one's going to build devices. No one's going to build applications to work on this network. There's no network. So why would the commercial world, why would the entrepreneurial side of things focus on this? And what's been gratifying about that is that that has exceeded our wildest dreams. The number of devices, the hundreds of applications that have been created, it's actually quite literally created an industry around public safety and public safety communications. And that's probably been one of the more satisfying things to us that were involved in this, because we were being told this was never going to happen. And we said, yeah, it will happen. But even we didn't expect it to happen at the level that it's happened so far.
Final question for you, Chuck. What needs to still happen moving forward to ensure FirstNet's continued success and effective evolution?
We have to acknowledge, as we always do inside public safety, that we don't have all the answers, that we will run into issues and incidents that we didn't expect, like September 11th. No one saw that coming, all right? We just didn't. And so you have to acknowledge that reality and acknowledge the fact that you just have to keep moving forward. You have to look at these things. You have to say, what's working? What's not working? How do we do this better? FirstNet, as an entity, is a work in progress and will always be a work in progress. As we've learned in public safety over the history of our successes and failures, is that you have to acknowledge when there are problems, when there are failures, and you have to address them. And so I think FirstNet going forward has that challenge and has to meet that challenge. And that's a good thing, because without that awareness, without that willingness, this will not be the network it should be. But I think that's already been acknowledged. I think that's accepted as a reality, as a tenet of this. And so I'm confident that we'll be able to meet those challenges going forward.
And that upbeat note is a wonderful way to end this conversation. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning into segment one of the story of the FirstNet Authority. As we looked back on the challenges faced by first responders before the events of the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks, we hope that you learned something from this segment and will check out segments 2, 3, and 4 as we continue to tell the story of FirstNet. This has been an exclusive Precinct 444 podcast series for the FirstNet Authority. A special thanks to Bill Beeman, our guest host. And as always, thank you to Christopher Mitchell for producing the series on the history of the FirstNet Authority.
Please subscribe to Precinct 444 on your favorite podcasting platform to stay connected and to receive our latest content as soon as it drops. We would love to hear from you. Send in your questions, comments, and feedback to precinct444@nleomf.org. You can help us make our content even better. The National Law Enforcement Museum is located at 444 East Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., and is dedicated to telling the story of American law enforcement. We expand and enrich the relationship between law enforcement and the community through educational journeys, immersive exhibitions, and insightful programs. Find us online at lawenforcementmuseum.org and stay tuned for more podcast content from Precinct 444. Until next time, stay safe. We'll see you at the precinct.